Welcome back to the Deep Dive. You know how sometimes you read these really dense philosophical texts and you just wish someone could, hand you the Cliff's Notes, or
Yeah.
maybe just the three most valuable sentences?
Exactly.
Well, today we're kind of doing that. We're diving into a set of notes and transcripts from this pretty profound weekend retreat on Advanced Vedanta. And we're basically searching for that ultimate diamond, the unchanging self. Supposedly hidden right smack in the middle of all this chaotic, changing experience we call life.
That's a great way to put it. Yeah, the core subject here is the Drik Drisya Viveka,
Okay.
which, translates roughly to the distinction between the seer Drik and the seen Drisya.
Here and seen. Got it.
And our mission really is to figure out how we move from just like intellectually getting it to actually having Aparakshajana, that direct, immediate knowing of reality.
Direct knowledge, not just theory.
Right. And the central problem the retreat tackles is pretty straightforward, actually. If the whole world we experience is, well, defined by change, instability, things falling apart, where can we possibly find the permanent, the unchanging reality? Let's call it the source or Ishvara. Where does it actually live?
Okay, yeah. Wait, is it? And the source material, it seems, jumps right in with this fantastic parable to frame that relationship between us, the individual, and the source.
It really does. It sets the stage perfectly.
Okay, let's unpack this first big idea.
So it's the story of the cosmic cousins. Swami Vivekananda used to tell it. You have Jiva, the individual soul, right? And Jiva goes to Ishvara, the big cosmic reality, and basically
Who
complains.
complains to God?
Yeah, essentially. Jiva says, look, we're supposed to be cousins, like two birds on the same tree, but somehow you got all the glory. You got the big avatars, Rama, Krishna, and I just got stuck with, paying the bills and all the suffering.
Okay, sounds familiar.
Yeah.
Like the ultimate sibling rivalry. So, what was the cosmic solution to this?
Well, this is where it gets really profound. Ishvara's solution is fascinating. Ishvara says, okay, fine. You, Jiva, you can keep the rupa, the physical form.
Keep the body, the appearance.
Exactly. And I, Ishvara says, I will take the nama, the name.
The name, that's the deal.
That's the deal. And this is the absolute key insight. The name, the essence, that's where the real power lies, not the fleeting form.
So it's not about who looks more important on the surface.
Yeah.
It's about the defining quality.
Precisely. Think about those names Ishvara took, Rama. It doesn't just mean some prince. It literally means one who brings joy just by thinking of him.
Oh, okay.
And Krishna, that comes from the root akarsharti, which means the one who attracts your own joy. See, the forms, they come and go. Rama appears, Krishna appears, but the essence you're actually searching for, that
Yeah.
inherent joyful nature within you, your Ananda Swarupa, that's the diamond. That's what lasts.
Okay, that makes a lot more sense. We're hunting for the permanent feature, not the temporary costume it wears. And this hunt, this search for the permanent, it immediately demands we change where we're looking, right? Which brings us to the core spiritual practice discussed.
Yes, absolutely fundamental. We are almost universally focused outward. On item, that's the Sanskrit for this, the external world, the objects, the people, the situations.
Stuff out there.
Right. And the pivot, the required shift, is to turn that focus inward, towards I'm the internal I.
And the notes give a pretty compelling reason why this pivot isn't just optional.
It's non-negotiable if you're serious, because the external world item simply cannot host the unchanging reality. The notes use this great analogy. Imagine the world is like a solid carpet, but every single time you step on it, it suddenly starts boiling, turns into liquid, changes color.
Whoa. Unsettling.
Exactly. It's fundamentally unstable, unpredictable. The source, reality itself, cannot be like that. It can't be defined by instability.
But hang on. If I start treating the external world like it's this boiling liquid carpet,
Yeah.
how do I function? How do I trust anything? Isn't that just, I don't know, spiritual bypassing, telling myself nothing out there matters?
That's a really important question. And it's not about escapism, not at all. It's about realizing where the stable point is. The notes really emphasize this. If the external world is constantly changing, then logically the only place the unchanging source could be hiding is within the internal self, within Aum.
Okay, so it forces the search inward, not dismisses the outward.
Exactly. It redirects the searchlight.
Yeah.
And practically, in daily life, this demands the really difficult bit, giving up those me and mine attachments.
Yes. That's where the rubber really meets the road, isn't it? We're all so deeply invested in my house, my kids, my career, thinking they are the source of our stability or
Yeah.
maybe our problems. How do we realistically let go of me and mine while still you know, being a responsible person.
It's about your internal stance. You still respond appropriately, you still fulfill your duties, care for your family, do your job, but internally, you have to consciously practice seeing these as the source's affairs flowing through you, not exclusively yours.
So detachment isn't indifference?
Not at all. It's clarity. When problems inevitably arise, when that external carpet starts boiling under your feet, the recommended practice is simple but powerful. Close your eyes, take a breath, and remember the truth. This feeling, this suffering I, this partial identity that's caught up in this, it's not the real I. You're basically narrowing the search for the diamond right inside the very mind that's doing the searching.
Okay, that sounds like, well, it sounds like it takes serious dedication. A lifetime, maybe. Which brings us to this rather stark warning from the scriptures that's mentioned.
Yes, the Upanishadic verse.
Nayam atma pravachane na mesena bahuna shutana labhya. The self can't be reached just through talks or intellect or even hearing a lot about it.
Exactly. It's the tradition's way of saying, look, reading the map isn't the journey. Knowledge has to become a choice, a lived reality. The self only truly reveals itself to the person who chooses it above all else.
And that's this concept of munukshutva.
Yes. Munukshutva. It's this genuine, internal, persistent desire and choice to prioritize the spiritual reality, the Paramatma, the source, in your own heart. It's not about just, you know, trying harder at your meditation practice. It's about fundamentally changing the internal direction of your life's energy.
But again, there's that practical tension. If I make that deep internal choice, how do I possibly maintain my commitments, my marriage, my kids, my job, my friendships, without just walking away from everything?
And the tradition is very practical about this. It gives a clear classification for managing action or karma to help navigate this balance.
Okay, how does that work?
You're guided to continue nitya karma, your essential daily duties, like basic self-care, maybe your core job functions, and also naimittika karma, occasional obligations, things that arise, like visiting a sick relative or attending an important family event.
Right, the necessary stuff.
And of course, you must absolutely avoid nishida karma, prohibited or harmful actions. That's a given.
Okay, so continue the necessary, avoid the harmful. That leaves one more category, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The crucial one for making progress.
Exactly, kamya karma. These are the actions performed solely for a desired personal outcome or activities that are just, well, unnecessary additions to life, distractions, essentially.
Ah, so those are the ones we need to address.
Those are the ones that need to be gradually, consciously, consistently pruned back. It's not just about saving time. It's about aligning your actual daily investment of energy and attention with your deepest internal choice, with your munukshutva.
I like that the retreat notes gave a really relatable modern example of this. The teacher mentioned giving up, like, obsessive sports watching.
Yeah, the 49ers games example.
Right. Hours spent watching football. Even though it's enjoyable and harmless on the surface, he realized it was blocking that deeper energy allocation.
It illustrates the principle perfectly. You have to be really honest with yourself about your priorities. You fulfill your necessary external duties, sure, but the internal priority has shifted completely. If you've truly internally chosen to find the diamond, you have to systematically stop spending your free time mining for, well, coal.
That clarity, that commitment,
Yeah. That's
what lets us tackle the next, maybe the most advanced and difficult part of this viveka, this distinction.
Yes.
The difference between the real self and what the teachings call ahankara.
This is really where the depth is. Ahankara, it often gets translated simply as ego.
Right, like Freudian ego.
But that's not quite it here. It's more fundamental. It's the I thought, the basic partial sense of identity that says, I am this person doing this thing. The problem is, this partial identity, this ahankara, it's constantly changing.
How so?
Well, think about it. There's the I that's awake right now. Then there's the I in your dreams tonight. There's the professional I at work, the parent I at home. It keeps taking on different roles, different forms. It shifts.
Okay, I see. So if the ahankara, this avidya, is always changing, how do we possibly spot the diamond, the real self that's supposed to be constant underneath it all?
We have to learn to look for the steady, unchanging element that illumines all these shifting identities. The notes use the electricity analogy here, which I find really helpful.
Right, the electricity and appliances.
Exactly. Electricity is the unchanging reality, the power source. Mm. The appliances, the fan, the light bulb, the toaster, they are the changing expressions, the different forms, powered by that one reality.
And when the toaster breaks?
The electricity is completely unaffected. It just is. Our mistake is that we, the individual consciousness, often confuse the real self with the chitchaya.
Chitchaya.
Yeah. It means the reflection or the shadow cast by that unchanging light of awareness. The texts even refine this distinction using reflections. There's apasa, which is like a vague shadow, clearly different from the original.
Right.
But then there's pratibimba, the mirror reflection. And that one can look almost perfectly identical to the original object.
Ah, so the problem is, our perceived identity, our ahankara, it's like such a high-definition mirror image of the true self that we mistake the reflection for the real thing.
That's it, exactly. That seems to be the fundamental human error, confusing the reflection in the mirror for the actual person standing there.
Wow, okay.
And this is why the journey of realizing this is often described in three stages, using that same mirror analogy. First, you're the samsari.
Meaning?
The person totally lost in the reflection. Completely engrossed, affected, feeling limited by whatever the world throws up onto the maybe dirty mirror.
Okay, stage one, caught in the reflection. What's stage two?
Stage two is vairagya, dispassion, detachment. This is when you start to recognize the illusion for what it is. The notes had that wonderful little story about the talking parrot.
Oh, yeah, the parrot.
The parrot's trapped in a cage, right. But it only finds freedom when it finally stops pretending to be useful or clever or entertaining for its owner. It just stops playing the game, stops engaging with the drama of the cage.
So just seeing the reflection isn't enough. You have to stop acting like the reflection is who you are or where your freedom comes from.
Exactly. You stop identifying with the role being reflected, which leads to the final stage, asangata.
Asangata.
Total non-attachment, unaffectedness. Like a perfectly clean, polished mirror, it reflects everything happening outside the traffic, the weather, people walking by, all the chaos and activity.
But the mirror itself
remains completely unchanged, unstained, untouched by any of it. It reflects the action, but it's fundamentally independent of the action.
Okay, that focus on the unaffected nature, the independence of the self, that leads perfectly into what the notes call the ultimate proof.
Ah, yes.
The movie experience analogy. This one felt really profound. This is the evidence the teachings claim is right under our noses every single day.
It's a powerful one. The analogy breaks down the experience of watching a movie into three components, arguing that you, the conscious observer, are actually all three things at once.
All three.
First, you are the fixed, colorless screen. That's the foundational reality, the substrate upon which everything appears.
Okay, the screen.
Second, you are the steady, powerful light projecting onto the screen. That's awareness itself, always present, always shining.
A light. Got it. Screen and light.
And third, this is the mind-bending part. You are also the moving film, the narrative itself, meaning you produce the script. It's generated from your own memories, your desires, your tendencies, the unfolding consequences of past actions, maybe even past lives.
Wow. So screen, light, and the movie playing on it.
Mm.
And the proof that we're the producer, not just watching someone else's film,
lies undeniably in the daily dream state.
Dreams again.
It's irrefutable proof. Every single night, your dream state demonstrates that you, without any external props or help, create and experience an entire world. You are the screen, the light, the scriptwriter, the actors, and the participant feeling the emotions of the dream.
Right, you do it all.
The notes really stress this. The source, Ishvara, dedicates roughly a third of your entire life to giving you this daily, undeniable demonstration of your creative power. And yet most of us just wake up and dismiss it. It was just a dream.
Instead of seeing it as the ultimate clue about our true nature.
Exactly. The biggest hint possible.
Okay, that capacity to produce our own reality, even in dreams, leads to the final concept about illusion or Brahma. We need to get this distinction between two types of illusion to really grasp how the world appears versus what it is.
Yes, this is crucial for practical understanding. The first type is the classic example. The snake rope illusion.
Right. See a rope in the dark, think it's a snake.
Exactly. And when someone switches on the light, what happens to the snake?
It's gone. Completely disappears. Never was real.
Correct. The illusion vanishes entirely upon correction. But the second type of illusion is different. It's called the blue sky type.
The blue sky type, suggesting the illusion sticks around even when you know better.
Precisely. Everyone learns in school the sky isn't actually blue. Space isn't blue. It just appears blue because of how light scatters in the atmosphere.
Right. Whaley scattering.
Yeah, whatever the science is. But even knowing that, when you look up the blueness, the illusion, it's still visibly there, isn't it?
Yeah, it still looks blue.
So once you become a gyani, someone who knows the truth, like an adult who understands the science of the sky, You see the appearance of the world like that blueness. It's present, it looks real, it functions in a certain way, but you understand it's an illusion, a superimposition on the vast, colorless, unchanging reality or source. The wise person recognizes the world show for what it is and is no longer fundamentally bound or fooled by its appearance.
Okay, that's a very helpful distinction. So wrapping up this deep dive into Drictrisio Viveka, if we had to boil it down for the listener trying to actually use this rather advanced knowledge, what are the two main actionable takeaways?
I'd say two things stand out. First, relentlessly, consciously change the direction of your primary focus. Shift it from the external world, from Adam, towards the internal self, Am, because that's where the diamond, the source, is hiding in plain sight.
Okay, shift focus inward. Takeaway one.
And second, learn to identify that diamond, not by its changing appearances, the roles, the thoughts, the feelings, but by its single defining characteristic, its unchanging nature, its self-existence, its swayam siddha. Look for what doesn't change within you.
Find the unchanging. Okay. And here's maybe the most provocative thought to end on, connecting right back to that opening parable. Jiva complaining to Ishvara. The notes seem to suggest you are already that Ananda Swarupa. You are already the complete satisfaction, the joy you're seeking. The biggest challenge in this whole spiritual game isn't actually finding the diamond.
But accepting that the diamond is you. Right now. And the entire search, the whole spiritual path, it really ends when the searcher finally realizes they are the source they were searching for. Those limitations you feel, the usefulness or uselessness you assign to your life, the whole drama you're trying to fix or escape, it's all just part of the script, your script. The final step is just accepting you wrote the whole movie, and you can stop identifying so fiercely with the character you've been playing.